everyone knows you're a tourist if you go Isla Mirada.
Isla Mirada. Okay. She didn't put that it was the Keys. She just said Isla Mirada. So she could have been Isla Mirada.
Give it up, Doug. What's the question?
Welcome to the Two Authors Podcast, an entertaining chat show hosted by best-selling mystery and thriller authors Douglas Pratt and Nicholas Harvey, in lively, humorous, and informative conversation with distinguished guests who share their thoughts and experience about forging a successful author career.
Welcome to the show, everyone. How are you doing, Mr. Nicholas?
Outstanding. Better for seeing you, of course.
Oh, I know. I missed you. It's been a couple of days.
Because you've been off diving, you rat.
I know. I haven't even updated my newsletter or my Facebook. It's been kind of just dragging because it's all been underwater. It's hard to do. Hey, but you know what? Today we have an awesome guest I'm excited about, Pamela Fagan Hutchins, and we're going to chat with her in a little bit.
She's really cool.
She's really awesome, yeah. But before we do that, I think we have a cool question. All right, this one comes from Olivia in Isla Mirada.
Isla Mirada, you non-Keys guy.
Oh my gosh. Why would you put the S in there? Isla?
I'm just telling you that everyone knows you're a tourist if you go Isla Mirada.
Isla Mirada. Okay. She didn't put that it was the Keys. She just said Isla Mirada. So she could have been Isla Mirada.
Give it up, Doug. What's the question?
Her question was, which of your characters would you love to create a spinoff book or series for? Other than Nora, what would you do a spinoff series from?
That's a good question, actually. Boy, I don't know. I got Reg, who's the old crusty. I could do a throwback series.
You could do a throwback series with him. That would be really cool.
Yeah, back in his Navy days or his salvage days. That'd be pretty cool. I think that would be quite interesting. Or if I wanted to do police procedural again, kind of like the Nora books, I could do a Whittaker one. Same thing. I could do a bit of a throwback.
Same thing. Go back when he was a young detective.
Before it's, because in current time, Nora's in the scene, but I could do a Whittaker one. But it would be fun to do like a novella in those worlds or something. Who's your spinoff?
I did the Corsair series. He was a spinoff. Technically, I dated a side door plot pilot kind of thing. I just kind of put him in there just so I could spin him off. But I'm actually just announced last week that the Ricky Talons from Deep Gold and Gulf Dreams, that I'm spinning that off into a series with E. Chris Ambrose. We're going to start that one into this year with the first book called Crossbones.
That's going to be cool because she's good.
That's going to be really cool. She's very cool. Yeah, it's going to be very... She brings a lot of the historical...
She does research, like serious research.
I'm like a Wikipedia research, and she's already gotten maps.
Next level.
Books. She's next level. So it's going to be really cool. It's going to be exciting to do. I can't wait. We'll see where we go with that one. But she's going to be exciting. It's going to be very much like a Lara Croft kind of adventure. So
We went quiet there because I'm just picturing Lara Croft. All right, moving on. onto the interview, because we can't wait to get to talk to Pamela Fagan Hutchins, USA Today bestselling mystery author with a bunch of series and her settings
all over the place.
From Wyoming, where she's based, to Texas, where she used to be, and down to the Caribbean, where she's also lived. So she's done it all. Let's get to the interview.
Welcome to the show, Pamela. It's great to have you today.
I really appreciate you guys having me here.
So how did you get involved in this madness? It's writing is not your original career, is it?
It's not even my second or third. I've bounced around a bit. I started as an attorney. I moved into human resources. I've been a private investigator, card carrying, which is fun at parties. But I got into writing in the third grade, and my third grade teacher told my parents I'd be a novelist someday. And I said, oh no, I want to read, not write. But in the end, she correctly predicted the future. And really, honestly, my husband, when I turned 40, said basically, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I said, a novelist. And so he prompted me a lot from that point forward. And it seems to have stuck.
Doug, when she said private investigator, did you immediately go, Like,
I did. I was like, hey.
Do you get that reaction initially from everyone? A touch of panic? Like, has she ever looked into me? Wait.
No. I was thinking more she needed a theme song, you know, like, you know, like, I mean, like Magnum P.I., you know, the whole thing, a big theme song to go with it or something.
I need a theme song.
That would be great at parties when you walk through the door. Just start playing the theme as you come through the door, an entrance. Get your husband on that. So you're Wyoming based when you're not gallivanting, and that's a big part of your stories.
It is. I really have two things that drive what I write. Place, and then the characters that somehow worm their way into the worlds that I write about. But what comes first is place. So when I first started writing, I was writing in the Caribbean because that's where I met and married my husband. And I had a lot of fondness for a big old house with a ghost there. And then we moved back to Wyoming where I'd lived as a kid. And the books, several series in a row now, have been there because it is truly where my heart is.
So I'm fascinated by this, the series that you have, because first of all, it starts in the Caribbean with one character, and then the series moves protagonists and locations. So talk to us a little bit about how it started. You met your husband there. So where did you meet your husband, and where was this focused in the Caribbean?
St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. He was born and raised there, and I moved there to work, and we worked together. So my best friend and my husband are from the Virgin Islands, and I spent years there. When I started writing, when, you know, that you're 40 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up? That was what was on my mind and in my heart, was how magnificent and wonderful and romantic that had been. Plus, we had a house with a jumbie ghost, so that was fun too. So I started writing, and that became three books. And I at that point in time, I liked doing three story arcs with a character within a setting. Even though I'm writing murder mystery, I'm very character and setting driven. And so I really think in terms of, like, if I write the first book, you know there's going to be three. If I write the fourth book, you know there's going to be six. If I write seven, you know there's going to be nine, because that's how my brain works on it. So I wrote the first three, and then I spun the best friend off from the States and wrote three in my hometown where I grew up. Then I spun off another friend and wrote three where we were living, which was South Texas. My husband's in oil and gas, so we were stuck there. And then I went back to the Caribbean for another friend of the friend for three, and then spun another character off and took her to Wyoming. And that was the start of Wyoming. It's when we had moved there. And that was the start of Wyoming. And so what I then had was this world where everyone lived in different places, but they knew each other, and we popped up in each other's stories, and I discovered that my readers really liked those Easter eggs. You'd be reading one book, and this character doesn't even really know the character from the first series, but their name pops up through a friend of a friend, or, you know, they come to know them in their book. And that still is happening today.
That's brilliant. So the reader's trying to guess who's going to be the character that spins off.
Who's going to spin off and who's going to show up. So even right now with my last few series, I wrote a series in the 1970s. I wrote characters into that one to appear. I really wrote characters in specifically because I was writing a contemporary series and I wanted to have them in both. And so I, even with a 40-year gap between the books, I was able to move those characters forward into the, what I wanted to use them for later. And I'm writing now for Bookature. So nod to the UK over there, Nicholas, because I'm writing for a British publisher. And the books they had me write were completely different. They're police procedural, but Wyoming, but character-driven. But, you know, serial killers and all that kind of stuff that I hadn't done before. And I'm Easter egging my characters from my other world, because Pamela has one world and her books have another world. There's only two, my real world and the book's world. And so to me, everything that occurs in all the series is in one separate world, and it all has the opportunity at any given point in time to overlap. And they do.
How many series do you have right now concurrently? And they all are concurrent. So how many do you have?
Yes. And some of them I'm writing concurrently. I don't know if you guys are doing that, but it makes for a lot of confusion in your own head. Not for the readers. They seem to get it.
I have that kind of trouble with one book. I don't know how I do with a whole bunch of series of them. So.
Yeah, it's like I don't want to stop writing one series until I finish three books, even if I have another one due, because I don't want to get out of my headspace for that character. But I have a super series that contains five series within it. So I think of it as five series, but they all interlap and interweave so much that they become a super series. Then I have the Patrick Flint series. That's eight books set in the 1970s in Wyoming. And then I have the Delaney Pace, Detective Delaney Pace books in Wyoming, of which I'm on the fourth book to come out this fall. That's the one with Bookature. And then I have a new series. I'm on the second book starting next month. I'm starting writing it in April. And that's the Jen Harrington series. That's a legal mystery series set in Wyoming. Basically, my agent said, write a book about a lawyer that moves to Wyoming and has a bunch of animals and solves mysteries and writes about them. And I said, you're asking me to write a book about myself. And he goes, yeah, write that book.
That's what you want.
And so that series is a lot of fun for me. And in fact, it's not me. I had took great pains to make Jen not me. And he said, and she'll have a really hot husband, but not in the oil industry. He needs to do something that a little bit interesting. He's a veterinarian.
Can I ask you a marketing question that kind of goes with how you're doing that? With that many series that are so entwined, how do you see when you release in one series that it affects the sales in other series? I mean, because they're so concurrent and in the same universe, do you see a boost in all your series at that point, anytime you have a new release?
I do, but not as much as if I was, say, doing rapid release in one series. So ideally, if I was a really smart author, I would have said no to Bookature. I would have kept doing what was working, and I would have continued to publish a book every 4 months or so in one series. Or even smarter, I would have written a few, held them back, and done a few, you know, every 2 or 3 weeks. That, I feel like, does the most. But even when, in fact, when I said yes to Bookature, I didn't publish any books at all for 2 years because they wanted me to write three books, do a rapid release, and I couldn't publish on a window on either side of that. So I had to hold back other books and wait until after. So I went through nearly a 2 year period of not releasing books. By the way, that makes no money, in case anybody's wondering out there. I mean, that is lose money territory. Even when you are already successful, have a name, selling tons of books, that's a quick way to lose money. But right before I said yes to that, I released, I'm trying to think, maybe it was number 7 in my Patrick Flint series at the same, within 3.5 weeks of when I published Bighorn, which is the first book in a new series, Jen Harrington. And the second of those two did the better because of the boost from the first. And then it pulled the other one up and it started doing better. And both of them did really, really well for a long time, but that just not long enough because eventually Amazon wants you to tickle the algorithms for them.
But I was just curious because I've heard that if you release anything, it'll tickle it to some extent. And I've only got, I just started my second series that I currently write, but Nick's writing two series at the same time. So you know, we were kind of curious how that would.
I think a couple of things happen. One is that on the retailers, it gives you some, you know, invisible boost that we can't, you know, us peons don't really get to know what's happening, but it feels like it gives you a little bit of invisible boost. It also gives you something to say on social media and with your newsletter. And I'm a big believer of that in that newsletter and that direct connection, you know, to your own list. It gives you something to remind them that maybe they didn't read the last book, or, you know, it causes them to go back and fill in the gaps sometimes. Not everybody, but some of them. And interestingly, then what Bookature wanted to do was take three books and release them all on the same day.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
Literally on the same day. I hated that.
That's more than a rapid release. That's an instantaneous release.
Which is why I went so long with no books out. You know, I had to write three for them. Then they held them to the exact what they thought was the right day. I had the other books, but I had to leave a window on either side of their release. And so it was a big, giant five book. You know, when I would have been releasing five books every 4 months, instead we went into this holding pattern. And honestly, I like rapid release a lot. And by rapid, I mean every, let's call it month, a little tiny bit less than a month. But I did not like the simultaneous release. And I guess we'll see in the end of the day what they think and what their numbers tell them. But I feel like you lose the opportunity to have hot new release type performance. You're still piggybacking on the marketing efforts of books you've already released. It's not like you're spending new marketing money really on each of them, because even if you simultaneously release, you're going to market each of these books. You're going to go for all the promos, the discount promos and everything else. But I feel like with the algorithms, you're missing an opportunity to have each book extend the tail of the other, right? You know, you have one tail, if you will, for the new release. You have 30 days of hot new release territory for three books instead of 30 days, 30 days, 30 days. Anyway, that may not have made sense, but that's how I felt about it.
It'll be interesting to see. I'll be watching closely because I'm starting a third series and I've got one written in the bag and I'm trying to decide what to write next because of the scheduling problem, right? So do I go to all three of my series, then releasing one every 9 months, or do I focus on, you know, when you're starting a new one, chances are it's not going to bring you in as much as the others, because although you'd like to wish your whole audience will come over, they don't to begin with, but it'll go bigger. Like my second series is starting now to go bigger than my first series, although it's got a third of the books in it. So what I should do is write more of those and backbone of the first series just a wee bit. But now with three, I've screwed myself, Pamela. That's what I've done. I've screwed myself.
And I have too. We are in the same boat, because you're right. You need a critical mass on those series to get people to invest in them. And I'll tell you that Bookature's theory was, we want the binge reading in Kindle Unlimited. This was a Kindle Unlimited experiment. None of the rest of my books are in Kindle Unlimited anymore. But that's where I am. It's like, do I just write one in each series a year, because of having four or five series going at once? Or do I spend a year or two and focus on one and then go back to the others? Because it does seem to be that you need a couple of books at a time within a series to regain foothold in them. Like just a one book release in a series that hasn't had anything, you know, for an indie. I'm not talking about somebody that's getting New York Times bestseller run, you know, promo money put behind them for Simon & Schuster. But for someone that's indie, a couple of books really helps to revive a series more than one does. So it's very, becomes strategically very challenging to decide what to do next, what to write next.
Well, we have a date, because you're going to have to come back on in 6 to 12 months and let us know how it all goes.
Okay, let's do that.
All right, I have a question for you, because this is of great interest to me. So most of your protagonists are female, but you have one, Patrick Flint, that's a male. So what drove you to write as a male, and what has the challenge been?
I was driven to it because my dad got cancer and he was given 3 months to live. And by the way, spoiler, it's been 4 years. He's doing great. But at the time, we thought we were going to lose him very quickly. And I wanted to write a book, even if only he would ever see it, that was the type of book he would love to be the hero in. And I sat down with him and asked him, okay, Dad. And of course he's going, what the hell are you doing? I put aside two other books I was working on, three actually at the time, that I haven't ever gone back to. I will someday. But I said, you know, who do you love to read? What's the style of the book? And he was like, well, I like Joe Pickett. I like CJ Box. And I said, okay, so you want Dudley Do-Right. You want a good guy who's a little fumbly bumbly, like you are, Dad, but he's smart and he's capable and he has a strong family and murders keep falling into his life and he can't help but have to be involved and accidentally solve them. And he's like, yeah, with a hopeful ending. And he talked through exactly the kind of book he'd want to star in. So I took all our family stories and I made all the characters in the book us. The bratty teenage girl is me. The younger brother is my brother. The mom is my mom. And I wrote kind of allegorically, in the sense that Switchback was the story of a young girl who was kidnapped. And in the process of trying to save her, everyone in the family is endangered, and maybe the father most of all, and only working all together and really relying on his wife, do they all come out okay? And allegorically, that's what I was trying to say about the cancer, right? And so I wrote that one. And then real quick, I rolled in and I wrote, I mean, these took me a month apiece. I mean, I was writing like the wind. And then they turned out kind of special. And we decided a few months later to release them. And by then, Dad was doing better. And people loved them. It's really been a success for me. And the challenge was less than one would expect, writing a different from yourself point of view, because it was someone I knew so well. It was my dad. And then when I took a step back and thought about, okay, in the books that I'm writing with multiple points of view, which is how I do all of them lately, no one's like me. Maybe one is. Maybe I identify with one most. And as a writer, you've got to be a student of character, a student of people, of human nature, or you have a cardboard cutout world where one vibrant main character resides within. You've got to be able to write all of the people, even the ones who are as different from you as they could possibly be. So anyway, that really launched me onto this soapbox or theory or whatever, that it's all about being able to write differently from you. That's where the growth is for an author, but that's where the most authenticity comes from, if you can do that well.
What an amazing story. And thank goodness your dad is hanging in there and doing well. And there's no better incentive to write books than that. I have a quick sidebar question. I presume, do you put dedications in your book? Did you dedicate this to your dad? How many tears did you shed writing a dedication to your dad in the front of that book?
Oh, so many. And it was so bad that I wrote this really long acknowledgement section about what drove the books. And I just reuse it for every book in the series because I can't keep re-examining that story. To me, they all start from the same place. But he's fun. And the books have been fun. Once he got the hang of it, he really enjoyed being Patrick Flint. And he enjoyed giving advice on the books and telling me whenever he thought I was being too hard on Patrick, or maybe he wasn't seeing Patrick the way, you know. It was really funny. And in certain places, especially in Wyoming, people really enjoy these books and they know Patrick Flint by the name Patrick Flint. Well, we tell them, this is Patrick Flint, when we drag my dad around. And he loves that. He loves people going, this is Patrick Flint. This is Patrick Flint. He's like, no, this is Peter Fagan.
You should take him to book signings and everything.
Yeah, right. Perfect. Yeah. meet the guy.
I had him on the podcast and it was an hour long show. And then we got done and it did really well. That episode did really well. And when it was done, he was like, well, we didn't even cover. And he's like, I need to come back on. There's so many more things to talk about. Dad, you're taking this way too.
A side point on the character stuff you brought up. Thinking about it, it's a great point, right? I think as writers, it's easier for us to write people we relate to and that we like. And it's easy to write people we do not relate to at all and dislike. So we've got this separation of the good and the bad, right? But there's all this vanilla stuff in the middle. That's probably the hardest thing to write. And the majority of the world lives in that space in the middle, right?
Exactly. I mean, don't you find when you're writing and you're trying to breathe some life into a character that has some importance, but isn't the bad guy, isn't the good guy, isn't their posse, you know, their close connections to either of them. And you've got to do their mannerisms and you've got to do their movement and their think about how they sound and, you know, what they like and don't like and how they'll react. That's so much harder. Because we're not as interested in them. But we have to get more interested in all those characters and think about them. And I really believe we have to not be scared to write differently from us. And I know that there's a school of thought that that's appropriation to write characters that are different from us. But if I only write characters that are like me, that looks a lot more like a non-diverse world. It looks a lot more
absolutely.
Like less old white woman just writing old white women. And that's not interesting to anybody. So I'm really excited when I have readers that are diverse from me that enjoy my Wyoming books with a white family, right? A white Christian hetero family. And apologies if I use the wrong words for any of that. I'm just old white lady speaking about my life and my experience from my point of view. But how boring would that be? That's not what the world looks like. And if I can't dig a little deeper and try to figure out how to portray the world that really exists, then my books are going to be very narrowly focused and frankly, vanilla.
Absolutely.
Very,
yeah.
That's very true. Yeah. I mean, I think we have to kind of branch out too. And it's good for us as writers to practice that, to get outside of our comfort zone sometimes.
Now, here's an interesting side point to that. If you get too far outside your comfort zones, then occasionally your readers don't follow, right? Because you develop a particular audience. And I discovered who mine was when I spun off everybody's favorite sidekick character in my Katie Connell books. But her best friend in the islands was a black woman. And everybody wanted more, more, more of her. And she's based on my best friend from the islands, Natalie. And so I thought, okay, well, Natalie and I will give this a shot, writing Ava. Oh my gosh, people did not follow me to that book. Now, the book is done well through the years. But for me, it was a flop. And it was a flop because even though people loved her as a side character, it was not somebody they, the readers, related to as a protagonist, even though I did. My gosh, I love those books. But it was interesting. And I have one that the lead character is based on my cousin, whose dad is from Mexico and his mom's from Texas. And I wrote basically her as a protagonist. And that's my second least well-performing book, even though it's the one that won a Silver Falchion. It did really well. The characterization, the reviews are the best I've ever had. But my readers, it turned out, looked like someone 20 years older than me, but me. Right?
Right.
And
yep.
so
yep.
they
yep.
they had yep. a challenge following me. And that's very, very real. And so I try not to let that get in my head. You want to write things that sell, but you also want to stay true to what it is that interests you and what you want to write. And you certainly don't want to curb your authenticity for the sake of political correctness or pleasing readers. You want them to be happy, but
writing to market.
Writing to market can be challenging because what if the market just wants you to write people that look like you? That's not interesting and that's not the world. So sometimes I push readers away a little bit in that I refuse to completely do that, but I do know who they are.
That's good. That's a be proud of that. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think same time that helps because oftentimes I think readers and we as people like, and I was talking to my wife about this more, we have a habit and our habit is to do what we're comfortable with. And sometimes when you see the just casualness of that discomfort or just diversity in general, that it becomes a little more normal. And maybe like, you know, people in Wyoming, I've actually never been to Wyoming, but if it's a lot of white people, I've loved to, it's on my list, but I mean, you know, that kind of diversity isn't in everywhere. And some people don't realize that, get to certain areas and it helps them see that and opens their mind in different ways. So,
yeah, in each book, I'll think to myself, here's where I'm going to push them outside their comfort zone. And in a way, I think maybe that's a wonderful thing to do because I can get my secret agendas across in a non-threatening way within characters in a world that they are so excited to be in. And I sneak in a little Pamela preaching without them ever realizing that that's what I've done. I had a series that was based in Texas, in my hometown, and I'm from Amarillo, Texas, for most of my childhood, which is, it's fairly conservative Christian environment. And I went pretty hard at my upbringing in these books. And I thought, oh gosh, everybody's going to hate me, but I'm writing what I want to write. And she's moving back to her hometown. She doesn't fit in anymore. And you know, there was a religious cult that were the bad guys in one of the books. And there was a immigrant child whose parents died that she tried to adopt. And you didn't realize how hard you were rooting for this little girl from Mexico to be adopted and stay in the U.S. until you got to the end of the books. But it was a statement that I was making. And people never realized I was making it because they loved the little girl. They wanted her to be okay.
Yep.
But I was making a statement and I knew I was making a statement. You know what I mean?
That's good.
And so, you know, you get the chance to do that with your audience when you have worlds that they want to be in. So that's kind of fun too.
I want to jump back to something you said earlier about your newsletter. You have a huge newsletter. I think you said you're very engaged with your readership. So what do you do to keep them engaged and get that kind of activity going with them?
I consider social media and, well, it's a funnel, first of all. In each of my books, I have links to my newsletter in the front and the back where they're offered a lead magnet that is consistent with what they like to read. So they're different in different series. And I'm trying to funnel people into my newsletter. And I don't do any direct advertising to get people to my newsletter. I try to make it organic from people that I'm advertising to read my books. And if they liked my books, then they'll sign up for my newsletter is the hope. I used to early on in my career do some of the paid newsletter promotions where you're trying to, I just felt like I always got a bunch of unsubscribes from that. I've culled maybe as many people as I have in my list. I cull very frequently. I have 15,000 right now, but I know that I've cut at least that many over the years because I want people that if I ask them to do something that they think of me like their book bub, you know, that they will take action upon books, whether they're mine or somebody else's, because I ask them to. I don't think I'm really there yet, but that's what I'm trying to do. And I use social media in an experimental way to see what it is they want to engage on. so that when the time comes that I want to talk about my books, these are all people who feel connected to me, enjoy my sense of humor, like my adventure pictures, are obsessed with sled dogs, whatever it is, but they are ready to tolerate, if not embrace, when I talk about my books without unfollowing, because they want to see the nostalgic joke I'm going to post tomorrow, or they want to see whose books I'm going to be talking about besides mine. So I do a lot of promoting of other authors, the podcast. I do a series Sunday where I put somebody's series up. I, you know, tons of stuff. And I have two different promo groups where we each promote one author a month for a year and give that author's book away in our newsletter at the same time as someone else in the group is doing it for us. You're only giving out free books. You are only doing it once a month, so you're not flooding your readers with stuff. But it's a long game, a slow build to building your subscription and to finding other authors who are complimentary to you such that you're helping fill the gaps between when all your new releases come out. And you're trying to build even bigger super fans out of your own fans by giving them more of what they want. So it's a lot of different elements to what I'm trying to achieve. Facebook, I don't own, and I could lose it at any day, but I definitely do try to build that followership and the group and stuff, because I feel like that's where my readers go to socialize, because as I said, they're 20 years older than me, but they're basically mostly look like me. Although that's not true. I get a lot of guys too, because my books are pretty adventurous. My books are very adventurous. There are as much adventure stories as they are mysteries. In sitting down to plot any book, it's like, okay, who dies? How do they die? How do we solve it? What's the character arc? And what exciting adventures are we going to tackle here? I want to be able to reach people where they want to be reached.
I think that's important. I think that's something that all new authors should be like, people who are like, I don't want to do Facebook and I don't want to do a newsletter. And I'm like, you're missing out on engagement. It doesn't have to be buy my book, buy my book, buy my book. And it shouldn't be. It should be more of an engagement and, hey, let me get you to talk. And
right. For the last 18 months, I've gotten notifications from Facebook, not every day, well, nearly every day, that says your engagement is up, your engagement is up, your engagement is up, your engagement is up. And it's because I'm purposely putting things people want to talk about that are either related to books or related to the settings of my books or related to the period those readers can relate to. I've learned their sense of humor. I've learned what the people that read my books want to talk about. And so I talk to them about that. And that means they think that I'm smart and funny. But I'm talking to them about what it is that they want to hear. So does that make sense? Then when it gets to my newsletters, I'm a little chatty, but not as much. And they're purpose driven. You know, this is a book you can have for free, or I have a new release or something like that. And, you know, two or three a month, four at the most, depending upon what's going on. But those people stay subscribed because they have an appetite for what I'm doing there as well, right? And so I don't go outside what it is they're looking for. They do answer me. Every month, people answer the newsletters because I ask them to, and because I want to see if they're really reading or what they're doing. So it's been interesting. And it really does mean that you have to think about, as an indie, but honestly, I think this should apply to every single author out there. You're thinking about who are reading my books and where do they want and what do they want? Not just within the pages, but to stay connected to me so that they're a super fan instead of a casual, I got this book for 99 cents, I might as well read it. But instead that when Friday rolls around or whatever day of the week it is, Monday rolls around and they see a post that says, what authors do you read, without even looking at the blurb or the cover, you want them to see Nicholas Harvey and Pamela Fagan Hutchins and the others. I was telling Nicholas before the show that I saw someone posting about us in the same post today with Craig Johnson and CJ Box and Lisa Reagan.
I'm pretty damn flattered, I can tell you.
I mean, I answered and said, thank you for including me with all the people I read. I think that's wonderful. But we want that kind of reaction, right? I do want casual readers. I want anybody that reads the books that it'll give them some joy and some escape and some happiness and, you know, all of that. But I also want the super fans that do those posts and that talk about you as if they're part of the family. Sometimes that's a little weird, I'm going to say, and other times it's good. It's been a grand experiment, and my kids have been entertained. My kids are all adults, and they're like, what are you doing with your social media? You're posting all these GIFs and memes, and, you know, I said, I'm entertaining my readers, and it's working. So back away from the keyboard and just let mom do her
thing. Don't comment. Yeah.
All right. So what do you think your author superpower is?
I think that other authors would say it's that I have perseverance and that I write prolifically. But what my readers would say, because after Doug told me that this was going to be a question, I asked my Facebook people, because I found that they like to talk about their opinions about you and your books too. And so I said, okay, what's my author's superpower? And most of them came up with something that made me feel like it was characterization.
That's what I read out of the comments that they left, yeah.
The characters, the reappearance of the characters, that the characters wouldn't leave their minds. They become part of their world and existence too. And so I think that would have to be it. But the authors will tell you it's that I work really hard and that I don't ever stop writing. So they're right about that too.
You can also work really hard at it and not deliver what they want.
Exactly.
And so you've got to be able to do both. So,
Doug, that really nailed it. You have to be a business person who writes what readers want to read. Otherwise, you know, you're still a writer, but you're just not being read.
Yeah.
And ideally, even you make
there are a lot of them out there that do that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Our final question now, we have, I'm not sure if you've listened and you'll be stealing this for your podcast.
Oh, you'll be all over it. Crime and Wine needs one of these.
Yeah, so we have a little wheel. It's our wheel of questions. So our very last question. You did the sound effects.
The sound effects are so good.
That is
you guys
really,
are awesome.
Like, we could have like paid for like a little, you know, little sound or something like that, but no, we went for the whole thing.
It's real. You guys, I'm looking at it. It is real.
Okay, so if you could go back to the beginning of your career, what is something that you would think about doing differently?
That's a hard question, because even the things that were incredibly expensive were really good learning experiences. Because my husband and I were looking at this as what would it take for an indie to get into bookstores, that we spent a little bit more time and money on that than I care about, because I don't care a whit about being in bookstores now. It's so expensive to be in bookstores. For traditional publishers or indie, these hard copies of books that are speculative and hold shelf space, that's a hard business. And I think we spent a lot of time and attention on that, because that was the traditional idea of what looked like success, was having your books in bookstores and having people queue up to come talk to you. And those things are wonderful. I still am a big believer in book events, and I love supporting bookstores that I can by consignment, but I no longer give a fig about being in bookstores. And I've made all my books through Lightning Source and Ingram unreturnable, because I'm just not going to play the game of getting the hit of those returns.
Right. Great. This has been brilliant, Pamela.
This was so much fun. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for coming.
Great. You've been wonderful.
That was a killer chat.
My She's brain amazing. Is a little swelled up right now from all that information she gave us.
I can
Holy
see it.
Cow.
Your dome is like extended.
It's
got a shine on it, a sheen.
Well, it does. It does. I polished it too. That helps.
So let's talk about this for a second, because this is an issue with every new author, because they'll hear this from every angle. And your newsletter list, you've got to run your newsletter list, you've got to be engaged. And the problem is, how do you start your newsletter list? And the first thing you tend to do as a new author, and I'm going to tell you this from experience, is get all your friends and family to sign up for your newsletter, because it feels better to have 60 people on there than it does to have 10. So, and then it feels better to have 200 people on there than it does 60. So you're going to do all these things to get these names on your newsletter list. And here's the warning. Be careful. Be patient. Because what you're doing is polluting that list. And when you come to run Facebook ads for your books, and you're going to create what's called a lookalike, which Facebook ads you can do with, you can input your newsletter list, and it will identify who those people from their emails and names, where they are on Facebook. And if they're on there, they go, okay, that's your fans. And then they make a lookalike, which means they take the attributions of those, that list you gave them, and find other people that have similar interests. Well, when you've got your friends and family on there, all of a sudden you've got bass fishermen, hang gliding fans, people who love pottery, and you know,
which of your friends, first of all, are doing pottery and hang gliding?
Cheryl Wood.
Is that your mom?
No, oh, yeah, Cheryl Wood. Okay. Yeah, she hasn't Cheryl actually been Wood, hang gliding, but she would if she was given the chance. And she was really good with the pottery wheel. We had one when we had a house. So now your lookalike audience is poisoned, right? Because it's full of these things that don't work. So you can segment your newsletter list and only feed in the real stuff. So that's one way of doing it. Most of the newsletter things, but just a word of warning, grow it as organically as possible. But quite honestly, when you start off doing newsletter swaps and doing the book funnel giveaways, just make sure that the groups that you're in are your wheelhouse. Then you can grow.
Also, I think the big thing is, and a lot of people do this, and I did this, I'm sure you may have done this, you start your newsletter, and then you send out a couple of newsletters, and then you go 2 years without sending out a newsletter, and then you send out a newsletter, and it says, hey, I got a new book out, because you're writing. I mean, everybody writes at different paces. You know, you and I write a lot because that's what we do.
Not compared to the others, though, right?
Oh, my. Yeah. Yeah. Pamela just now, whoop.
Yeah.
But some people are writing one book a year because they have a full-time job.
Especially when starting.
But you can't just wait until you have a book to send out because the people who are on your list will have forgotten they've signed up for it. Like Pamela said, you're trying to build super fans. And I'm telling you what, like, increasing engagement is the number one way to build super fans. You know, you start sending out, you know, a regular newsletter, I mean, at least once a month. I don't have a set time. I do it all through it. You know, sometimes I do it once a week. Sometimes I do it twice a week if I feel like I've got something to say. But go on your, make sure you have a social media. I mean, we all hate Facebook.
I hate Facebook with a passion. My personal Facebook page, I don't touch because I wish I could never be on it. But it's
such a necessity. And so if your goal is to sell books, like there's a few things you can't avoid. Facebook is probably one of them. Amazon's one of them. I mean, you can decide not to sell your book on Amazon, but you're not going to sell nearly as many books or hardly any at all if you go that way.
Well, and even if you go wide, you're going to sell them on Amazon still. So,
right. So get a Facebook. You don't have to join all your have friends. You can have one. You have to have a personal page to set up a author page. But then like Nick does, he doesn't even use his personal page. He just simply uses his author page. And you start posting regularly so that you can start building engagement. Because the more you post, the more Facebook's going to show people that you post. So,
and it doesn't have to be super fancy. Just come up with stuff. Like every Tuesday, you're going to post a funny meme about dogs. If you have a, you know, there's a half of, like we talked about Lisa Reagan, who's an absolute sweetheart. And she's a brilliant, brilliant writer. And she's got a fantastic social media presence, and she has this dog, Mr. Philip, and half of her posts are about Mr. Philip, and it and first of all, the dog's freaking hilarious. Look, it's a hilarious looking
dog. It builds engagement.
Absolutely. People comment, and people look forward to seeing pictures of Mr. Philip on there and stuff like that. Lucy Score, who sold a couple of books in the last couple of years.
She's kind of prolific.
And she talks about Mr. Lucy. That's what she's called her husband, Mr. Lucy. And so a little trigger, right? Just something like that. If you got a pet pigeon, you know, build it through that. Whatever it might be, just find a hook and find
something to get on there. Yeah.
And the newsletter once a month is fine. Just keep ticking it in there and give them something personal. What are you reading? What did you just read? Promo somebody else's book in there.
I'm telling you, like the biggest engagement I get is from my kids and my dogs and the trips we take sometimes because people don't want to hear about buy my book. They want to, your fans, your super fans want to be your friend.
And then you put in there, hey, I've got a new book out. Right. And then you get
sometimes
some
they just post pictures of Nicholas Harvey just to see if, you know, anybody's paying attention.
Those don't go down so well. There's not so much engagement.
Yeah.
Check out our show notes for links for guest information. We got all the stuff on Pamela in there, where to find a book, her website, and look for new episodes every couple of weeks. So until next time, be cool to each other.
Fair winds and following seas.
You've been listening to the Two Authors podcast with Nicholas Harvey and Douglas Pratt. Subscribe on your favorite platform for alerts on new shows coming every 2 weeks.